Hello, and welcome to a special podcast edition of Around It About Chattanooga. I'm Michael Edward Miller. I'm here with Richard Winham, and this one is going to be a lot longer than what we normally do on Around It About. Generally, it's three stories. The show is about 20 minutes long. This is going to be an hour-long conversation with a musician that I imagine most of the listeners have heard of.
John Funberg, or Funsberg, right? It's perhaps telling that I'm not entirely sure of John's name. We started this conversation, and it was absolutely a conversation. It wasn't an interview. I think what are those guys been making music for like 30 years? He's been interviewed a lot, and I think how do I know what he was thinking? But the impression I had was that he was like, okay, what time is it? How long do I have to do this? All right, put him on. And I knew he felt like that. I could sense that. And so I just thought, well, let's just chat for a while. Get him to drop his They Might Be Giants persona and just talk to me, you know, which in fact he did, which is a blessing and a curse from our point of view as radio professionals, as we like to think of ourselves. First of all, the reason that Michael is running this piece as is because there isn't, as you'll hear when you listen to it, there is no other way to do it. This does not lend itself to a Q&A or an edited, polished presentation. In fact, there are a number of points in the interview or conversation where John makes reference to that. What exactly are you going to do with this? You know, I don't see how you're going to make this work, you know. Don't worry about that, John. You know, I say cavalierly, I'll make it work. So what you're going to hear is John Funsberg from They Might Be Giants, who are going to be playing in town on Sunday evening at home, chatting with a bloke that he didn't know from Adam. But by the end of the conversation, I think we both sort of felt like we'd made a connection with each other.
Sounds good. Let's hear it.
This is a little weird. I'm not used to doing these phone things. I know Terry Gross does it this way all the time and seems to be a lot more comfortable where she doesn't have to look somebody in the eye.
That is her métier.
Yeah.
Not looking people in the eye. In fact, you've
talked to her?
Oh, yeah. We've been on the show multiple times. We've actually been on Fresh Air, I think, three times.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, over the course of 30 years, that's the weird thing is that we were on the show very, are we spinning? Are we recording?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Grand.
Yeah, we're just talking.
They Might Be Giants has been on Fresh Air. We were on in like the late '80s, right as we were first blowing up as an indie act.
And of course, she was at that point just going national too, right?
Yes, and you know, there was my memory of the show is a little bit foggy, but I remember when we did the interview being very pleased with the level of discourse. Like there's something about doing there's something very flattering about the show and a lot of kind of, inside the actor's studio is like kind of the perfect example of like a show that will get the best out of a lot of people just because they feel like they're being celebrated, which is a really positive spin to have in play when you're being interviewed. But I remember being so excited to be getting treated so respectfully because up until then, you know, we would often be on shows where people were really projecting on us what they wanted us to be, which was a much brassier kind of comic thing. Like they just were like, you guys do the funny music, right? All right, you're going to be on the radio show. All right, here we go. Be really funny. And like, you know, we were just, you know, what we do, the way the humor is incorporated in what we're doing is very deadpan in general. And we're certainly not going to be like necessarily yucking it up unless it feels natural to do so.
Right.
So we were really excited about doing the interview. And then when I heard it, I actually heard my own voice really kind of for the first time. And I realized I said the words like and you know so frequently that I just sounded like a very stoned surfer from California. And it was very, very disturbing to me because It was just part of my affect that I had never examined. And
yeah,
I was very, I don't know if you say like or you know naturally, but it's something that really comes across.
Well, I tell you, John,
badly.
I have been doing this, actually, now we're thinking about it. I started in radio in 1972.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't ever talk to anybody who's older than me.
It makes me sound like a fossil.
You must be crazy old, man. I bought a tape recorder in 1972. It was like basically my first musical instrument, and I just pulled it out of the sort of storage area of my house and plugged it in. And for the first time since I bought it, I've kept it maintained the entire time.
Way to go. It's a little two-track machine?
It's a four-track, a TX four-track.
Yeah.
And I just plugged it in, and for the first time ever, it completely doesn't work.
Oh, that's too bad.
And I don't even know how I would get it repaired, because it's not really a professional machine. It's kind of a semi-pro machine. It's not like part service. It's like hard to get parts. So you've been doing radio since 1972? How old were you when you started?
20.
It was,
when I first came to the States.
Oh, well, you are what we call a lifer in entertainment.
A lifer, yeah. It feels that way. It feels that way sometimes, you know. I know how a lifer feels.
Like, I mean,
how the hell did this happen, and why am I still doing this?
Well, with your heavy Southern accent, I can see.
That's part of it.
It's been a barrier to your.
Jeez. There's so many different ways we can go from here. One thing that I wanted to say to you was, it was 1966. It was the summer that the Brits beat Germany, and they're still crowing about that in the World Cup. I worked the entire summer. I was in high school. And I worked the entire summer so that I could buy a tape recorder. That was my goal.
And what kind of tape recorder?
I don't have it anymore. It's
Was it an Akai or a Sony or?
Who knows? It was a little reel to reel.
Right.
Was
it a Revox?
No. This was a definitely domestic, very much like, well, how much money have you got, kid? Well, I've got this one. And, it came with a little microphone about the size of a pack of cigarettes. And
one thing that's very strange about about digital recording is that, when you got your tape recorder, I'm sure you immediately played with, like, the speed control, right? And, there was a thing called a pitch control, which basically could kind of make it sound like you were breathing helium, or you could do it down an octave or up an octave, which was kind of the chipmunk control. Doing any of that stuff with digital recording is so much more complicated and less satisfying than, with all the versatility that digital recording offers people, it's surprising how hard it is to reproduce those simple, if I want to just kind of do a simple kind of sped up Prince vocal, or like a slowed down drum track to make it sound like, something off of Revolver. Those are very, very difficult effects to create in this creepy, crummy digital world. I want to go back to my TX tape recorder. That's exactly why I broke out the TX tape recorder. There's a bunch of things I wanted to do with pitch change. And you can't really do it that easily.
With everything you gain, you lose something, I think it's just the nature of the beast.
So what was the first rock band you interviewed?
Good question.
Oh, come on. You have to remember.
Well, the very...
I worked with a lighting guy who did lights for Pink Floyd.
Really?
When they were the Pink Floyd. And it was funny because we heard that and we just immediately assumed, oh, this guy must be totally for real. But the truth of it was he was essentially like a high fashion lighting person who only worked in New York. And he was terribly underqualified to do an actual rock show.
Especially Pink Floyd. I mean, that was what they were all about, right?
They were presented. And in many ways, the truth of it was when he was doing lights for the Pink Floyd, it was pretty much about just building a light show, not traveling with a light show.
Right.
It was ridiculous.
I remember light shows very well. They were a lot of fun. John, at this point, the first people I talked to was a duo called Diodorf and Rodney, and I remember that because
Diodorf and Rodney.
Yeah, and I kept saying to
was this a British band?
No, they're American, and the problem was
Diodorf. What is the etymology of Diodorf?
Good question.
That sounds like they're from Hamburg, man.
It does. And of course, you know, they were working against a huge impediment in that Batdorf and Rodney were fairly well known. And so I kept calling them Batdorf and Rodney, and he kept correcting me.
Telling me there's a Diodorf and Rodney and a Badendorf and Rodney? I've never heard of either of these bands.
Batdorf and Rodney had some hits.
I'm telling you, literally one third of my brain is filled with liner note information, and I've never heard of either of these acts.
Well, check out Diodorf and Rodney. Odds are you never will. I don't know if they had a record. They came by the station at a time. This was in the mid 70s.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't that opportunity like there is now, where on any given week, there's at least one band that wants to come into the studio, play some songs, and talk about what they do.
Right.
Back in those days, people didn't do that. You know, we weren't set up for it. We had a guest microphone, and that was it. And when I first started here in 1987, we had one microphone in addition to the microphone over the board.
Right.
Which, you know, so you get this, the bluegrass thing where everybody crowds around the microphone and you try to get something that sounds like something.
Right. Now, and you also, you know, it's interesting. You also had people who were very reluctant to even talk in a way that would make them. It was kind of that like teenage boy thing where a lot of guys in bands would just be like, I would rather not talk just to remain looking cool.
Right.
And you know,
the more you talk, obviously, the more you reveal yourself.
I don't know if you've ever seen this blog called Dangerous Minds blog, but it's a fascinating. A lot of the postings are about drugs related stuff, like sort of like Timothy Leary stuff. But he's also very preoccupied with the birth of punk rock, and he posts very rare YouTube videos of the first generation of New York punk rock, new wave bands, which is kind of, you know, a personal obsession of mine, just having been, I'm really of the age, I was 17 in 1977, speaking of...
Oh, perfect.
Speaking of our personal decrepitude...
Did you go to CBGB?
I did go to I went, well, actually, I grew up in Boston, and the Boston analog of CBGB's was a place called The Rat.
And you had Oedipus, right?
I knew Oedipus before Oedipus was Oedipus, really.
Because he was the guy that, more than anything, who championed punk, wasn't he, in Boston?
He was. He was. You know, Oedipus was a very sweet guy. He was a little bit more, well, like a lot of DJs, he was a little bit more of a cultural chameleon.
Mm.
I think the writing was kind of on the wall for California rock at the time in 19. I mean, the times I hung out with. I mean, I remember I came back from England, and I loaned him punk in September of 77, and loaned him records that I had purchased in England, including like the first Elvis Costello singles, which were at that point not out in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he played them all on the college radio station there. It was before he was on BCN. It was he was on I think it actually might have been called WTBS, which is, of course, the name of the Atlanta superstation that Ted Turner, like Turner Broadcasting.
They bought the letters.
Call letters, but it's basically the Emerson College radio station was WTBS back then. The Dangerous Minds blog. They played an interview with Television, and you know I love the band Television completely, and I was so kind of saddened to see them being interviewed, and they were just such like kind of wise ass. It was like talking to like boys in a detention hall. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just not up for being. You know, they weren't. There was no way that they could seriously talk about what they were doing, and I just thought, how sad. Like here they are, they're making this incredibly sophisticated music. You know, those television records. I mean, there are only a couple of television albums, but Little Johnny Jewel and the first Marquee Moon. I mean, those are amazing recordings.
No doubt. But Tom Verlaine never struck me as particularly verbose. You know, he's just so.
But then there's the whole
punk. You're right. I think I
thought he was kind of the male analog to Patti Smith. I would think he would be kind of a fascinating and maybe candid interview, but he would not. Give it up.
No. I think there's. I think truth be told, there's two kinds of musicians. There are people who are comfortable with an instrument in their hand. And they sort of come out of themselves, but the minute you sit them down and want to talk to them, they're not quite sure what their role is anymore. And there are those who can stand back from what they do and talk about it in very articulate terms. Elvis Costello, you just mentioned, is a perfect example of that. Or I love listening to Pete Townsend talk about music. You know,
because
he's as much he's almost like a professor, you know.
Yeah, he can be very melodramatic, though, I have to say.